Imagine a world where huge numbers of older Americans, and some younger ones too, will submit themselves to killing clinics, supposedly for the benefit of those they love. They become heroes.
That disturbing thought becomes very real in Dr. James Dobson's brand new novel, Fatherless, but it's a scenario that co-author Kurt Bruner explains could become a catalyst for change.
As the world gets darker and darker, the family as God designed it becomes more and more brilliant as a shining light. That's part of what we hope will happen. People will read these novels and realize, yes, it's getting darker and darker, but I can love my spouse, can nurture my children, and realize that it's the creation of those bright spots that will over time dissipate the darkness that's rising.
Request your copy of Fatherless today at drjamesdobson.org. That's Fatherless at drjamesdobson.org.
Welcome to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and your host is psychologist and best-selling author Dr. James Dobson.
And I'm Luann Crane, and today, Doctor, we are joined by a brand new friend of yours. And I really have to say, I think you two are kindred spirits because you're both dedicated to the values of the American family.
And both of us have come out of Texas. People
this
don't
is
know
true.
That I'm a Texan, but I am. And in fact, Ryan and I went to a ranch in Texas this year to hunt, and we met our guest today, John Erickson.
Yeah.
That was a very special time because he spoke at that event.
Absolutely. It was great. We were there with some people from Patrick Henry College, which means it's going to be a great time. And our guest today came and spoke, and it's going to be fun letting our listeners know who he is.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Erickson may be a familiar name to many of our listeners because millions of people know him. I think he's written over 80 books now. I thought I had the record with 82, but you got me beat, John. And a lot of yours have been about a dog named Hank, Hank the cow dog. And the moment I said that, many people say, oh, I know about those books because you've been writing them since 1982, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. 30 years.
And you are an honest-to-goodness, real-life, genuine cowboy, aren't you?
Well, as a cowboy friend of mine once said, it depends on who's in the room when I answer that question because there are cowboys who know a lot more and are a lot better with horses and ropes than I am, but I was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It was something I wanted to do. When I was 5 or 6 years old, my mother she was a ranch girl from Seminole, Texas, down around Midland and Lubbock, and they were cowboys and ranchers, and some of them were Quakers, by the way.
Hmm.
They started a little Quaker community.
You're still a cowboy, aren't you?
Yes.
You have about 6,000 acres.
I do, and I developed the skills of cowboying, working for other people, and it's all every cowboy's dream to have his own ranch, and I was able to do that because my dog paid for it.
And as you sit here, you got a weird little tie-like thing that hangs down, which nobody in the rest of the world knows about. But that's a cowboy tie, isn't it?
It came from a Western store in Pampa, Texas.
And let's talk about your writing. You were a cowboy full-time for, what, 6, 7 years?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you began writing these stories about a dog named Hank the cow dog. And you sent them off to publishers and got turned down over and over and over again.
I started writing in a disciplined way when I married Chris. I'd written in an undisciplined way when I was in college, when I had an idea or an inspiration. Usually at night, I would write poems or an essay or letters. But when I got married to Chris, I was in my second year at Harvard Divinity School, and I took a fiction writing course in the Harvard Yard, which had been taken by John Updike and Norman Mailer when they were there.
Pretty good credentials.
Well, they were big name writers at that time, and I was proud to be sitting in the same classroom where they were. Once I got married, it brought some meaning into my life, and I couldn't live in dumpsters anymore. I had to figure out what I was going to do with my life.
Now, Doctor, that was worth the whole program right there. Did you hear what he said? Once I got married, it brought meaning to my life. I like this gentleman.
I like that we've got a cowboy that was at Harvard Divinity School taking Harvard Lit classes. That is an anomaly, too.
That illustrates the fact that this is a very unusual man. Mm-hmm. And I saw that when we were together. And Shirley and I fell in love with John and his wife, Chris, who's sitting over here against the wall today. And they're just very unusual people and very talented people. You spoke to our group there that night about Hank. Mm-hmm. Was there a real Hank?
There was a real Hank. I was working on a ranch in Beaver County, Oklahoma in the 70s, and a neighbor of mine had an Australian Shepherd. And Australian Shepherds are stock dogs. Mm-hmm. They are bred for hundreds of years to do something with sheep or cattle. And this dog had those instincts, but nobody took the time to tell him what to do with them. So what he did was stand in the gate and bark and chase the cattle, get the cows stirred up. And people were always mad at him. The cowboys hated to see that dog come around because he made our job harder. And they were always screaming at him, Hank, get out of the gate. Hank, get in the pickup. Hank, go to the house. And Hank shut up the barking. And so I remembered this dog. He had a good heart. He thought he was head of ranch security. He mm-hmm. was driven by a powerful mission, which was he was protecting this ranch mm-hmm. from the Charlie monsters who come out at night, from the coyotes that want to eat Sally Mae's chickens, and he has to bark up the sun every morning or the sun won't come up. He has to bark at the mailman or no telling what that mailman will do.
Those were real characteristics of the original Hank, or did you write them into your story?
I wrote them into my story. I just took this dog who had no self-knowledge but had an exalted opinion of himself. And he never understood why people were mad at him. He thought he was such a good dog, trying to do his best. And so that was the basis of Hank. And then the other characters, Drover was a little dog that worked on another ranch that I worked on. Drover lived on that ranch. He was just a little mutt. And he never caused any trouble. Kids love Drover because Drover is afraid of things. He's always his signature line in the Hank audiobooks is, oh, my leg. He says that every time there's a loud noise or he's afraid of something. He goes and hides in the limps into the machine shed. And
so Hank was ready to take on the world, and Drover was scared of everything.
Yeah.
And they were friends.
Yeah. And they sleep under the gas tanks. There's a couple of gunny sacks underneath the gas tanks, and Hank refers to it as the security division's vast office complex. Sometimes he even talks about being in his office on the 12th floor of the security.
Well, you're revealing something that's very important in understanding these books. They're written in first person.
Yes.
With the dog speaking.
Yes.
And all of them are that way, aren't they?
He's
telling a story. How did you write the first one?
Well, the first Hank story was a short story that I wrote for the Cattleman magazine. I used to write a lot of humorous and technical articles for the Cattleman magazine, and I wrote strictly for money. I had a wife and two hungry kids, and they paid me $150 a piece for articles, so I wrote humor about what I was doing every day, which was working as a ranch cowboy.
How did you originally start writing, though? Because you talked about being an undisciplined writer before you met your wife and then becoming more disciplined and taking courses. your first stories early on. What got you into writing? What made you think you could write or do essays or write poems or any of that?
You know, I never wrote anything till I was in the 12th grade. I might have written a few things, but not much. Mm-hmm. We didn't know that writers could come from a little farm and ranch community in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so I got a great background in grammar and sentence diagramming. I had some tough English teachers in the 7th and 8th grade.
Why, I did too. Yeah. We must have had the same teacher.
Remember when they'd write a sentence?
Yeah.
And then underline and then the line that...
With all the slash through it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. They fill a whole board. Today's students don't even know what diagramming is. Mm. And as a result, they don't understand grammar.
Yeah. Well, I got a great background in sentence diagramming and grammar, but I never thought about writing until... 12th grade, my English teacher made us write an original poem. And I was on the football team. All the other guys groaned and moaned and pulled their hair out because they couldn't write a poem. I'd never written one, but I just had a feeling that I could. So I wrote poems for her, and she gushed over them, said they were beautiful. And so I wrote poems for her for the rest of the semester and eventually put them together in a collection, the Collected Poems of John R. Erickson. That was my first book.
Oh. What was the first Hank book called?
It was called Hank the Cow Dog.
The original. That makes sense. And then you submitted it to publishers.
No, actually, I had been sending manuscripts out to publishers for 15 years before I wrote the first Hank book. By the time I got the first Hank book, I was so beat up and discouraged, I didn't even send it to anybody. Mm. I had tried to figure out how to write for New York publishers. I joined the Western Writers of America. Chris and I went to conventions when we couldn't afford to, and I chased editors and agents around hotel lobbies and tried very hard to figure out what they wanted. And some of the time, what they wanted was something that I didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. Other times, I just couldn't figure out how to write what they wanted. One of the most famous rejection slips I ever got, I told this story one time to a ranch audience in Texas. And I related the fact that I sent this manuscript to a New York editor whom I'd met at conventions. And she wrote back and said, "This book has too much integrity and not enough sex."
Hmm.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, I got a lot of those rejection slips, and probably 1,000.
You're kidding.
Wow. No. You've got tenacity.
A thousand.
Some people would say that I wasn't very smart, but... We lived on a ranch, and I would drive 3 or 4 miles to the mailbox every day to get the mail because I always had query letters and manuscripts in the mail. And I kept waiting to get somebody to accept what I was doing. You know, I recognized the possibility that what I was doing probably wasn't very good because I had spent 6 years in universities, and I had learned some very bad habits, not only in terms of what they were teaching in those universities, but also in terms of writing. I think I wrote better in the 4th grade than I did after 6 years of university training. So it took me 15 years to unlearn a lot of bad habits and probably to get over youthful arrogance and ignorance. Yeah. Hmm. So after 15 years of writing, I stumbled on Hank. Hank fell out of the sky in my lap, and I didn't recognize it as the blessing it turned out to be. I didn't think it was necessarily the best thing I'd ever written, and I thought one of the best things I'd written was a short story about a horse breaking experience that I'd had with a 5-year-old horse that was pretty convinced that he wanted to kill me and another cowboy. And I called it Diary of a Bronc, and I wrote it from the point of view of the horse. Mm-hmm. And I read that story in chapel at Patrick Henry College 2 years ago. And it took me a lot of years to realize how biblical that story is, because it's a story of human disobedience and the rebellion against authority. You know, a horse by himself makes a nice photograph, but he's worthless as far as doing anything. It takes a human being to take the time to teach him how to giddy up and whoa, and how to turn right and left.
I know some kids it's hard to teach that too.
Yeah. Yeah, we have that book. Yeah, we sure do.
You know, we've kind of walked a similar path, because when I was a sophomore in college, I had an absolutely fantastic composition teacher who really began teaching me how to string words together. And I had some time one day, and I just decided to see if I could get something published. So I wrote Sports Illustrated, and all I did was write a letter to the editor. But it was a pretty good letter, and they published it, and that was my first publication. So the first thing I tried to publish was successful, but it was a long time between that and the next one. So it is a lot of hard work to really write well, isn't it?
Yes, I always thought that I was a good writer, even when I wasn't. But the Hank stories are the work of a mature professional writer. And, you know, they are perceived as children's stories. And schools and homeschoolers place the reading age around fourth and fifth grade. That's kind of the core audience of the Hank stories. That's when kids are falling in love with reading, and they want to find something that they can fall in love with.
John, you have spoken all across the country. In fact, as we were coming in the studio today, you said that you really ruined your voice by speaking so much and so often. So you don't do it as much as you used to, but you could captivate an audience with those stories, couldn't you, quite honestly?
Well, I've done enough programs where I'm a seasoned professional at doing the Hank voices and songs and characters. And
speaking of songs, I am really disappointed that you didn't bring your banjo today. We've never had a banjo played live for our radio program. And your wife, Chris, sitting here to my left, plays the mandolin, and the two of you play together, don't you?
Yeah, and we sing in the church choir, and we're missing choir practice tonight because of you.
I'm sorry.
We're working on our cantata, so Chris and I are going to have to go back to the ranch, and we've got a CD. We're going to have to practice it. I got an email from Barbara Richardson, our choir director, this morning that reminded
us. And blamed it on me, didn't
it? And I said, we're going to be AWOL tonight, but I think you'll understand why. And I said, we're going to be doing an interview with Dr. Dobson. And she wrote back and said I was forgiven.
You give her my regards.
Okay.
And apologies.
In fact, Mr. Erickson, you've mentioned the fact that Hank the Cowdog is a series. In fact, I believe there's over 60 in
we're
the series,
bring out
60 books. And I just kind of wanted to point out that number 19 is a little bit of interest to us here because of the inscription at the beginning. Explain to us who you dedicated book number 19 to.
Well, the book dedications are pretty special to an author. You dedicate books to people you admire and people who have helped you along the way. My first book was dedicated to my mother and father. Hmm. And I've dedicated books, a number of books, to Chris and to my grandmother and my mother-in-law. But on number 19, we were in the process of raising three children. And Chris discovered Dr. Dobson. I'm not sure even how that happened. At a homeschool convention, maybe, or on the radio. But Dr. Dobson was a part of our family, and helped us raise our kids and gave us wisdom in times when we needed wisdom and it was hard to find. And I just had an enormous admiration for Dr. Dobson. And it occurred to me, I think that I was thinking one time about if I had to name Americans that I admired the most, and it occurred to me that Dr. Dobson would be at the top of the list. So the dedication of the 19th Hank book was to Dr. James Dobson and his wife Shirley in appreciation for all the contributions they'd made to the American family.
That's very generous, John, but you didn't tell me about it.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until this year.
What year
I mean,
was
you
that
could
published?
Have at least sent me a copy of the book, and I've found out about it in Texas at the ranch.
It was 21 years ago.
21 wow. years ago. That's right.
Well, as I told you at the ranch, when you came up to me and looked at me with those stern eyes and said, "Why did you do that?"
I said that?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
At breakfast the next day. Yeah. And I said, "You were busy, and I knew that you would find me."
Hmm. Is that right?
Yeah.
And it took 21 years
it
for us to come together.
And you were busy, and I was pretty sure that if I sent you that book, you had gotten 20 other books from people who loved you and admired you that same day, and you would probably not see it. Hmm. But I knew that our paths would cross. It was just meant to be.
Well, I do get a lot of books and more than I can read. But I would have read this one because I'm a dog lover. John, our time is gone. By the way, the book number 19 that we were just talking about is called Hank, The Case of the Midnight Rustler. And it's still available, isn't it?
Oh,
all
yes.
your books are available.
They're all in print, yes.
When you read a portion of that while we were at the hunt, which I thought was really neat to hear the author read his own story, that was fantastic.
Well, John, if you don't mind, we're going to talk to you again because you've come a long ways. You flew here from Texas, and there are the things I want to ask you about. Mm-hmm. So if you will permit, just stay right where you are. We're going to go on recording, and we'll let people hear what we're about to say tomorrow.
Great.
Okay. Thanks for being here. And, Chris, we didn't hear from you, but I appreciate you coming as well. And your publicist, Nikki Georgiakakis. Did I get it right?
Yeah,
she is also here, and we will pick the story up right here.
Okay.
And to find out how you can get your own copy of Hank the Cow Dog Adventure, come to drjamesdobson.org. My kids love Hank the Cow
That's
Dog.
That's what I heard.
I play the audio recordings in carpool, and you've never seen five kids under 10 so quiet for that long.
Well, that's worth it right there. Mm-hmm. So obviously, this is a series you should check out. There are a whopping 61 books in all, so we highly recommend this to spice up your carpool ride.
And we're getting ready to jump into summer, which I might add can be very lean for us financially. So if you could consider partnering with us, it would really help get us through. And we will use every single penny wisely into God's glory. You can do so online at drjamesdobson.org when you call 877-732-6825. Again, 877-732-6825. You can also donate on our Facebook page or via our Family Talk smartphone app.
And thank you so much for spending this part of your day with us. Do return tomorrow for the conclusion of our conversation with John Erickson, the author of Hank the Cow Dog.
You might even hear Hank the Cow Dog sing.
It's worth tuning in. Yes. We will see you next time right here on Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.
A very wise man once said, "If you love something, set it free. If it comes back to you, it's yours for life. If it doesn't come back, it never was yours in the first place." That simple principle has great relevance in romantic relationships. Some individuals are so anxious to find someone to love that they begin to smother the man or woman. That's like turning a fire hose on a flickering flame. I heard about one young man who was determined to win the affection of a girl who even refused to see him. He decided that the way to her heart was through the mail, so he began writing her a love letter every day. When she didn't respond, he increased his output to 3 notes every 24 hours. In all, he wrote her more than 700 letters, and as a result, she married the postman. That's the way the system works. Appearing too anxious and too available actually drives other people away rather than attracting them into a committed relationship. Why? Because love is a function of respect between two people. And those who grovel and beg produce only disrespect for themselves. Let me put it another way. Romantic love is one of those rare human endeavors that succeeds best when it requires the least effort. Remember that cautious lovers usually like to nibble at the bait before swallowing the hook. Those who jerk the line too quickly rarely ever catch the big one.
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com.